everyone, and welcome to the EdTech Podcast, the show about education innovation in and out of the classroom. This week, we're releasing the final episode from our South by Southwest EDU 2017 EdTech Trends series, this time on literacy, language, culture, and innovation. But first, a recap of our event announcements. Ovum's Future EdTech event takes place in London on the 13th to 14th of June. It's free for unis, and EdTech podcast listeners get a 10% discount by entering the code edpod/10 at the reg checkout. Back on the Higher Ed Focus, I'll also be chairing an event on everyone's favourite topic of the moment, GDPR. Full Fabrics event as part of London EdTech Week takes place at Imperial College on the 22nd of June. And finally, don't forget the EdTech Podcast's very own event on Is EdTech a Thing? A live podcast in collaboration with Nesta and supported by Cooley LLP, running on the 19th of June and looking at how we should value EdTech from an educator, legal and investor perspective. It's free, but you do need to register, and all the links for these events are in the show notes. This week's podcast is sponsored by Qatar Foundation International and Class Central. Qatar Foundation International, QFI, is a US-based member of Qatar Foundation, QF. QFI operates as both a grant-making organisation and a convener of thought leaders on issues related to global and international education, open education and education technologies, as they intersect with the three core QFI programmatic areas: Arabic language and Arab culture, STEAM, STEM plus the arts, and youth engagement. QFI inspires meaningful connections to the Arab world by creating a global community of diverse learners and educators and connecting them through effective and collaborative learning environments inside and outside the classroom. Through their activities, QFI is committed to providing K-12 students in Qatar, the Americas and the United Kingdom with the intellectual, communicative and cultural competencies that will enable them to be engaged global citizens. If you'd like to find out more about subjects such as how to teach children about the refugee crisis, to teaching about Arab cultures or teaching the Arabic language, go and check out their website at www.qfi.org or listen to Maggie in this week's episode. So, what have we got this week? Well, I'm in conversation with Dr. Shlomi Katan, Senior Director for the XPRIZE, Matt Keller, Prize Lead for the Global Learning XPRIZE, Maggie Mitchell-Salem, Executive Director at the Qatar Foundation International, Mark Nagurski, co-founder for the animation content studio Makematic, and Tricia Edwards, Head of Education at the Smithsonian's Levinson Centre for the Study of Invention and Innovation. We're tackling questions such as, what are the global educational problems of our time and how can the psychology of competition help to solve them? What do inventors look like and how can we think of both ourselves and our young people as inventors? What's currently wrong with educator CPD and can a new approach improve upon existing professional development? And what teaching resources are available to help educate on Arabic cultures, language and connectedness between young people globally? It's a great episode with loads of book recommendations, resource ideas and thoughts about how to get good ideas set in motion. As always, send your feedback to @podcastedtech on Twitter, and if you like the episode, post a quick rate and review on iTunes. If you love the EdTech podcast, check out our Patreon campaign, where you can contribute from as little as $1 a month towards our running costs. Have a great week, everyone. Favourite spots, looking out across Austin downtown at South by Southwest EDU, and I'm delighted to be here with Dr. Shlomi Katan, who's a Senior Director at XPRIZE. So welcome, Shlomi.
Thank you, Sophie.
And let's introduce your colleague as well. So it's Matthew Keller.
Matthew Keller, Senior Director of the Global Learning XPRIZE at XPRIZE.
Wonderful. And so for those people who are listening in and who aren't perhaps familiar with XPRIZE, can you give us like a quick overview of what it is?
Yeah. So XPRIZE is a nonprofit foundation that's been around for a little over 20 years. And we design and manage large scale competitions. So competitions with prize purses in the millions of dollars. The largest one we've had is $30 million to really spur innovation across different sectors. We got our start in space exploration, but we've since launched competitions in ocean health, human health, and of course education. As Matt mentioned, he leads the Global Learning XPRIZE, which was our first learning competition. I lead the Adult Literacy XPRIZE, which is the second one we launched in that sector.
It's quite interesting because, I mean, I think when we think about education and perhaps, you know, the purpose of education, so would be hopefully to create individuals that can work together, that can solve some of these global issues. So why, you know, if that's not working, why do you think that might be?
So our general hypothesis at XPRIZE is not that the solutions are not available. It's that there are reasons that specific problems don't get addressed. We tend to call them market failures, but the basic idea is that either people are not aware that there's a problem, or they think that the problem is impossible to solve. They can't imagine that it hasn't been solved. Matt can talk about the history of the Global Learning XPRIZE, but the Global Learning XPRIZE addresses the needs of more than 250 million children who have zero or very limited access to schooling. Adult Lit addresses the needs of nearly 780 million adults around the world who lack basic literacy. And when you throw those numbers out, those seem, they're very big, but when you put it as a rate statistic, so for adult basic education, you're talking about one out of every six adults around the world lacking basic skills. Mm-hmm. When you put it in that, in those terms, people are usually shocked, and it's not uncommon that they just cannot believe that that's the case. And so when you face problems like that, sometimes there are opportunities to develop technologies that can solve those problems. The beauty of the XPRIZE model is that rather than saying let's fund solutions that already exist, it's using the psychology of competition, mm-hmm. and obviously the prize purse itself to get innovators from around the world to really try to solve that problem. You know, in a sense, we're relying on the genius of the crowd to come up with really new and innovative solutions that otherwise wouldn't exist.
And so, Matt, on your side of things with the Learning Prize, how long's the Learning Prize been going as part of XPRIZE as well?
So we launched the Global Learning XPRIZE in September of 14, so almost 2.5 years, and we had a huge response from teams around the world. And right now we're in the phase of going through the submissions and coming down to the top five. Each of those top five will receive $1 million and then be required to open source both their code and their content. And this is a prize sponsored by Elon Musk.
Amazing. I suppose there's the link there between space exploration and Elon Musk and what he's up to as well. And so is that an annual prize on the learning side?
So these are multi-year prizes. Okay. So the Global Learning XPRIZE will be about 4.5 years in its entirety. The adult literacy is 3.5 years. And so what we're doing at XPRIZE is looking at a whole suite of possibilities. What else, what other challenges are out there that we can incentivize people to solve? And there'll be a number in the, you know, the learning area, for example.
And so we're yet to see who's come out of the prize.
That's right. So we haven't yet seen the winners, but that will be happening, you know, in the relatively near future. And we hope that what comes out of this is innovation that changes the way that people think about learning. Mm-hmm. And if we can prove what we've set out to prove, then we think that that will result in some major change.
And the change that happens, so is, I mean, is there a kind of geographical context to it? Are you looking for it to have impact all over the world or in areas where there is sort of lack of access to educational resources and so on?
I think the application will be global. So for example, in Global Learning XPRIZE, if we can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that children in the most dire circumstances can teach themselves how to read, write, and do math without the aid of a literate adult, then that application will be used, I think, for people around the world. And Shlomi can talk about the Adult Literacy Prize, but this is technology designed to teach people how to do basic things themselves, how to read themselves, how to do math themselves.
So addressing some of the sort of student-teacher ratio issues and things like that.
Right. So there's roughly around 70 million kids who have no access to school, another 250 million who go to school and leave without ever having learned to read or write a word. So this is about access to quality education. And the dream is that someday you can hand a child something. It could be a smartphone. It could be a teddy bear. Who knows what the platform is. And that child will have a mentor for her next 12 years. And that will she will learn from it, and it will learn from her in a sense. And that content, the way the child learns, and the mentoring aspect of that thing will be able to reach every kid.
And what are your both of your backgrounds, and how did you both get into this prize?
So before XPRIZE, I worked for a group called One Laptop Per Child.
That's what I was thinking. And when you mentioned the smartphone or the teddy bear, it got me thinking.
Right, yeah, with Nicholas Negroponte. And we did a lot of work around getting kids access, designing the hardware itself for kids in developing countries, but introducing the idea that kids have no access, and technology is a way to scale that access to quality learning.
And how do you get around some of the connectivity issues in some of the more remote areas?
XPRIZE, we're not, the tablets we're giving kids won't be connected, but with One Laptop, you know, we were, in some places, I think we helped spur connectivity. In Rwanda, for example, they did a massive laptop deployment, which in part was a reason for widespread internet access around the country. So some cases we were the cause, the spur, which was great. Other cases it was built for the projects.
Okay, interesting. And this week, so you've both been out at South by Southwest EDU. What kind of conversations have you had, and what kind of organizations or individuals are you looking to partner with to help achieve your mission?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we're already, I mean, anything of this scale. So Matt mentioned it's the total prize purse for global learning is $15 million. The total prize purse for adult lit is $7 million. To give away that kind of money to one company, for the most part, right? It gets split a number of different ways, but the bulk of it will go to one winner. We have to prove that these things work. And in part, we have to prove that they work because we want wide-scale adoption.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to a question you asked earlier about, you know, are these recurring prizes? Part of the reason that they're not is, as Matt said, if we can actually prove that with nothing more than software, both kids and adults can read, can learn to read, that's proving something that hasn't been done before.
Mm-hmm.
No one has actually built learning software that on its own can get people who otherwise have not been able to acquire basic skills to gain those basic skills. If we can prove that that works, then we can get adoption only if we've proven it in a way that meets certain standards. And so Global Learning is rolling out a field test in, what is it, 150 villages in Tanzania. Adult Literacy is doing a field test with as many as 12,000 people in 3 metropolitan regions of the U.S. Anything of that scale requires a lot of partnerships already. So Global Learning is working with WFP, UNESCO, and the government of Tanzania. For Adult Lit, we're partnering with Comcast Internet Essentials, the City of Philadelphia, the Los Angeles Unified School District, the Community College District of the City of Dallas, and actually dozens of smaller organizations in each of those cities to really roll this out. Now, here at South by Southwest, we wanted to accomplish 2 primary goals. One, really, XPRIZE competitions are all about innovations that come from the teams.
Mm-hmm.
And we had teams that were already here. One of the teams for adult literacy called CellEd was one of the 10 teams that got to compete in the launch pitch competition. We set up an industry hub for 2 teams from Global Learning and 2 teams from Adult Lit to present what they're doing. We really want to see those teams succeed and those teams meet the type of folks that they'll need to work with going forward. And then for us specifically, Matt mentioned that we have these 2 prizes and we will be launching other education and learning prizes. And really, South by Southwest gives us an opportunity to connect both with folks that we've previously worked with, mm-hmm. and folks that we want to be working with going forward, that will allow us to really think more broadly about how XPRIZE can influence and impact the type of access, the type of quality, and the type of potential that technology can provide to both education and learning.
It's quite an interesting one as well, around the idea of it being global and scalable, but then having relevance in terms of, I mean, you mentioned sort of villages in Tanzania versus sort of inner city kids here or adults here. How do you kind of localize your solution once that's been chosen so that it will have measurable outcomes in so many different circumstances? And perhaps this may have been something that you experienced with the one laptop per child project, but
So I'll pass it to Matt in a minute to talk about one of the really unique things that Global Learning is doing in terms of open sourcing the winning solutions. But for adult lit, one thing that we've always encouraged teams to do is to make sure that they are already working with local organizations.
Yep.
So that they're building solutions specifically for adult learners. Adult learners, you know, most software developers are not themselves adult learners. They're usually hyper-educated. And in a lot of technology startups, and this is also true for education technology, entrepreneurs tend to build products that address a need that they're intimately familiar with, because they've been through the system themselves, they've been learners themselves. But most of them are not adult learners. And so getting to understand what adult learners go through when they use a smartphone, it's not even localizing it geographically, it's really using a design thinking approach to address the needs of a particular set of folks. But really, XPRIZES are about what the teams create, and ultimately part of the reason that we provide these large grants at the end to the winners is for them to really go out and propagate what they've done.
Mm-hmm.
And to really expand it and do that. But I'll pass it over to Matt to talk about.
And is there, in terms of accountability, once they've won the prize money, because I guess there's that risk, isn't there, of, like, you know, having so much money and it being spent, and it has to, you know, have that impact, because certainly in the UK, in the ed tech sector, that people always kind of throw back to, say, maybe 20 years ago when the government were sort of injected a lot of money into the sector, but it wasn't spent very effectively, because I don't think there was that sophisticated conversation yet about, you know, what's the pedagogy. It was like, oh, look at this shiny thing. And I think that has moved on, but, you know, it's a massive position of responsibility, isn't it, in terms of the value.
Absolutely. So that's one of the really interesting things about the XPRIZE model, is that it's not a grant for work to be done. It is an award for work that has already been done. The winners, I mean, going through a 12,000 person field test to prove that one of the solutions works is a massive research undertaking. And so the team will have already had to build a solution that works to win the prize purse. One thing that we've built into the Adult Literacy XPRIZE is a second stage to the competition that we're calling the Communities Competition. And I'll let that pass.
Rude. So it's all part of the Austin flavor.
So the Communities Competition is actually a second type of competition where communities from around the U.S. will compete to distribute the top tools from the first stage of the competition, which is the R&D stage, to distribute the winning tools from that to as many people as possible around the U.S. Mm-hmm. And the winning organization will be the winning community will be the community that distributes those tools to the largest number of people. That's one of the ways that we're actually ensuring that we see implementation at a massive scale. But again, by the time anybody wins any of the money, they have to have actually accomplished the goals that we've set out. So,
and Matt, I don't know, because we're quite far along in the process of the prize. Do you guys already know who is going to be successful?
Not really. I mean, I have a sense of who the better teams are, I think, based on some of the past work they've done. So I'm hoping that whoever it is, again, as I said earlier, develop something that is so different from what we have that it'll be effective. And it may not work. We may prove that, actually, you know what, this is not a good use of money, and let's spend it somewhere else in something that does work. So I think, you know, either way, we don't want to engage in the kind of flim-flam that a lot of ed tech has at its
very
core.
Polite way of putting it.
What's that?
That's a polite way of putting it.
Yeah, right. So.
And just in that, so what's the process in terms of judging? So do you have a panel of judges from across academia? And I mean, I just, yeah, just understand.
Right. We have the Global Learning Express has 11 judges, and they are from the fields of neuroscience, gaming. They're in academia. They're Teacher of the Year in Tanzania, the Teacher of the Year in Canada. So it's a really eclectic mix from five different countries that will be looking at the applications, going through them, and based on their, you know, perspective and experience and judgment, they'll make essentially what are qualitative assessments of these applications, and they'll get down to the top five. And then again, those top five will be required to open source their code and content.
It's hugely exciting. And I always ask the interviewees, you know, what their own educational experience was like and how that perhaps shapes, you know, how you approach education in the world as well. So if you could both share that, that would be great.
I was, my education was shaped by the Jesuits from a very early age. In fact, wanted to study to become a Jesuit myself. So I was heavily influenced kind of by the theology and philosophy of that group of people. And it's kind of been carried through for really my whole life.
Yeah. And how about yourself, Jimmy?
My educational background?
Yes.
So I was a bad student. Quick learner, bad student, which I think is typical of people of my generation who went to school in an education system that, you know, saw everyone as just having to work towards taking certain tests and get certain grades. And I think that has actually been it's probably been the big reason that I went into education, is to try to understand how to create a system that is more equitable, so that it gives more opportunities to folks who have a harder time within the system and allows folks who have an easier time within the system not to become bad students.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause it's a, you know, I mean, you know, we XPRIZE is part of a whole kind of entrepreneurial ecosystem. And I know that in Silicon Valley, there's a lot of lionization of the bad student. Right, mm-hmm. The rebel, and I don't want to traffic in those types of cliches, but I do think that sometimes you need a combination of folks to really lead to reform, and sometimes those folks have to be people who saw the system as not working for them, and sometimes you need folks who did actually work well within that system, and having those combinations of perspectives is important. And I think that has actually been very influential in my life and my understanding of what kind of education reform I'd like to see happen.
And can you tell us a little bit about the founder of the prize, and then you also mentioned sort of Elon Musk partnering on the learner aspect of it as well, just so people listening, if they're not familiar with both of those figures, can just learn a bit more about them.
So our origin story is actually, it goes back to the earlier part of the 20th century. So most people know who Charles Lindbergh was, and they know that he crossed the Atlantic. What a lot of folks don't know is that Charles Lindbergh crossed the Atlantic to win $25,000, which if you translated it to today's money would be around $375,000, which is a lot of money. But it's not that much money to risk your life and try to be the first person to fly from New York to Paris. Our founder, Peter Diamandis, is a space guy. He's a guy who always was fascinated with space exploration, started International Space University, started a national student organization that is still operates today. He had started a couple of satellite launch companies and was trying to really think about how do we get to a point where private space exploration is a feasible and real thing, and read a book about Charles Lindbergh and said, I'm going to do that same thing for space exploration. And there's a book that came out that your listeners might be interested in reading called How to Build a Spaceship, that is the story of that first XPRIZE. And it's really an amazing story of just hustling for a really long time to make something happen that when Peter started with it, everyone thought was absolutely impossible. Absolutely impossible. And it worked. And it worked so well that one of the people that Peter went to try to fund the prize purse. At the time, it was the largest private prize purse ever awarded. It was $10 million. And one of the people that he went to was Richard Branson. And Richard Branson turned him down. But the day that the prize was won, Richard Branson went and acquired the license to the intellectual property developed by the team that won. He believed in what Peter was doing, but I think it
he needed to see that it was going to happen. Maybe.
Yeah. And it's an amazing story. And once that worked, then Peter has said, you know, he's quoted. I know it's a common quote, but it's Peter has said, success has 1,000 parents, failure only one. Once it worked, suddenly there were a lot of folks who saw the potential in the model, and that's what led to other competitions that are really have done amazing things to change how technology is used to solve some real problems.
That was going to be one of my questions, actually. So I suppose the competition itself is about tapping into that psychology of competition to sort of draw the best up. But then at the same time, you've kind of got like a meta competition going on between competitions. So you've got things like, sorry, that was a ridiculous sentence, about the IDEAM Prize. You've got like the Varkey Foundation. I don't know if you know about their Global Teacher Prize. And, you know, I just wondered what your thoughts were on those multiple prizes out there and actually, kind of what that means.
So I think like any, even though we're 22 years old, we're a relatively young and pioneering company in this space. And one of the best things you can see when you enter a space that previously had been more or less dormant. I mean, prizes have a very long history. Governments are actually the biggest investors in prizes historically. But when Peter launched the first X Prize, the field was pretty dormant. And today it's very active. By some estimates, it's a $2 billion industry. That is, you want to see that. You absolutely want to see other folks adopt that model. XPRIZE does certain types of prizes. Other organizations do other types of prizes. We've historically been a prize organization. We are really much more of an impact organization. Prizes are just a tool that we use to achieve that impact.
So it's really like a social impact investment firm, but of sorts.
Of sorts. I mean, we're trying to generate impact in different sectors that otherwise wouldn't see it. And the competition model, incentive prize competition model, is a very, very effective tool for doing that. It's an amazingly leveraged tool. One thing I didn't say about why Peter was so attracted to this prize model was because to win that $25,000 that Charles Lindbergh won, the 14 competitors collectively put in more than $400,000. So 16x leverage for the Ansari X Prize, which was the first one. That was the one that the company ended up becoming Virgin Galactic. $10 million prize purse, more than $100 million invested by teams. That is amazing leverage, and it leads to a ton of impact. And I think seeing other organizations adopt that same model is a very good thing if you care about social impact. And it's a very good thing for us because we want to see that validation. We want to see that there are others entering the fray and doing the same thing. And and that's just, it's a good thing.
And then another question I ask everyone is if there are any books or resources or people that have had an impact, and it doesn't have to be, you know, in what you're doing now, that you kind of go back to that sort of shaped your thinking as people involved in this space as well, that others may listen in and think, great, I want to go and read that book as well.
Well, for the Global Learning X Prize, there's a book called The Diamond Age, which is about this young girl getting access to this book that is her mentor and equalizes opportunity and access for everybody. So that is a great book, and I think that is the future of access to quality education. And then another book in general that kind of shaped the way I think about the democratization of organizing, of tackling problems, is Common Cause by John Gardner, written, I think, in 1970. And he started a group called Common Cause. And it was really about organizing people in a way that empowered them to solve problems that we all face in our government. But that is applicable in many different areas, including prizes. And one thing Shlomi touched on was that this kind of explosion of organizations that do prizes means there's an explosion of people around the world who are being asked to solve problems that nobody ever would have asked them to solve before. And so they compete using their own genius, right? They may not be part of, you know, a recognized institution. They may not be in academia. They may not be part of it. They may just be sitting at home with a great idea. And they get asked, and they can join for almost nothing and contribute what they have to solving the world's problems. So that, I think, is a real power of what we do at XPRIZE and other foundations that do prizes. But in Common Cause and the Diamond Age are the two that I can recommend.
Yeah, so a book for me. So this is a completely different type of book. Both of those are great books, and I think very influential. This is a completely different type of book, and it's one that's actually been very important in formulating my worldview in general. But it's one that, on its surface, doesn't seem to have much to do with education, but I think it provides a heuristic for understanding power dynamics, which I think education, just as a system, and learning as a process, and in general, the way we treat one another, are all structured by the same types of dynamics. It's Albert Memmi, M-E-M-M-I, Portrait of the Colonizer and the Portrait of the Colonized. And that book has been, for me, a very, and it goes along with a few other books, including ones by Frantz Fanon and, and Jean-Paul Sartre, that really helped me to understand in ways that I couldn't previously articulate the extent to which all of us, especially those of us working in education, have to really take a hard look at what our role is in setting power dynamics and how they affect folks. And, you know, both the Global Learning XPRIZE and the Adult Literacy XPRIZE are, they're social impact competitions that are asking people who use technology to address needs of two of the most vulnerable populations on the planet. One of them are kids who not only have very little access to education, they have little access to education because they live in extreme poverty in many cases. And adult learners, you know, I mentioned 780 million around the world. Around the world, two-thirds of them are women. Usually that happens because women are denied access to education. So by the time they reach adulthood, they can't read. And in the United States, it's actually happens to not be the same split as globally, but it's very much influenced by poverty, by the prison system. 70% of prisoners in the U.S. are low literate. And in the U.S., the prison system, which processes as many as 12 million people a year, is really organized around certain...
There's a really interesting one on that as well, because I interviewed the CEO of the British Dyslexia Association. She was saying that there's a really high proportion of dyslexic learners that are also in the prison system. And it's
correct.
You know, something about, you know, perhaps that can be tracked back to you haven't felt supported and, you know, you can't advance your learning and then...
Right,
kind and of life goes off on a tangent.
Yeah, and kids who, so by some estimates, this is Sally Shaywitz writes about this. She's one of the foremost scholars on dyslexia, and she writes about the fact that as many as one out of five people in the United States have dyslexia, and that's actually true around the world. It's around one out of five, and that 80% of so-called learning disabilities are really dyslexia. But what happens is those kids start getting identified as troublemakers. They start getting taken out of the school system, put into the criminal justice system, put into the prison system. Dropout rates are higher. But I think in the United States especially, it also correlates a lot with race. Mm-hmm. And then it also, in the United States, is very heavily influenced by immigration. And we are living in a time in the U.S. and I think the world where those populations are more vulnerable than they've been before. And something like the Adult Literacy XPRIZE, which allows people to access education outside of the existing system, mm-hmm. for the most part, creates opportunities for folks that otherwise wouldn't have it.
Yeah, no, it's at the I attended Web Summit this year, and it was really interesting because, you know, I attended a panel where there was a lady from TechFugees and Andrew Harper, the head of innovation at UNHCR, and you know, calling to attention. You know, you've got a lot of these people, a lot of people out of the Silicon Valley, a lot of people that have had the privilege of access to amazing education, that are there, that are very smart, that have these tools. And, you know, a lot of what's created is, you know, perhaps something about like, you know, a nice media app. You know, these are huge issues in the world that are yet to be solved, and trying to galvanize people around that. And I interviewed Andrew Harper about how technology might sort of help address getting teaching and learning to 65 million displaced people on the planet. And he was talking about exactly that, like, so how do you get that experience to someone who may culturally not be able to, you know, go to a school, or, you know, building schools in refugee camps can't be scaled. So he was talking to chatbot companies about that, because, you know, you still initially need to triage that service before you can get what learning experience. It is that absolute scale of the issue is right. It's kind of it's almost too large to get your head around.
Right, but as Matt said, if we can actually prove that you can learn using a device, whether you're a child in rural Tanzania or an immigrant to the United States living in a city like Philadelphia, if we can prove that that works, then suddenly you're able to really scale that up, right? I mean, you know, by some estimates, by 2020, 5 billion people will have a smartphone. In the United States already, it's above 70%.
And most of those people probably have like one or two or three devices. Would that be correct?
I don't know in terms of device distribution to them, but yeah, you've got a lot of folks who have access to this technology that, you know, as Peter likes to say, is a supercomputer in their pocket. Mm-hmm. That provides us an opportunity for scale that we otherwise wouldn't have. And, you know, Matt has talked about how the cost of these devices is going to go down and down and down, especially once you have 5 billion of them out there.
We've got the Nokia retro phone that's just come out as well.
But and it's interesting because the thing that increases the divide, which is technology, kind of paradoxically, is the thing that will bring us closer together. So access is the issue. And how do you drive down costs, and how do you increase access simultaneously? And I think that's what we're trying to do, in a sense. And we serve as a domino that will set in motion a chain of events that will lead to access. Because if you believe that learning is a human right, that education is a fundamental human right that serves as the foundation for any kind of economic success, certainly, in general, then that access becomes the central question.
So my final question is, the prize isn't annual and it's just about to come out. And then I just wondered what's kind of the next focus for you? So once the winners are announced and, well, it sounds like you have more awards coming out. So perhaps that's the answer, but.
I'm trying to think of getting through a field test of 150 very small and remote villages and about 4,000 children. And making that happen over the next 18 months is all I can think about. So you have a distribution that's geographically very challenging, demographically very challenging. So right now, that's all I can think about. And then at the end of that 18 months, we'll chat again.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, to Matt's point, I think in both of these competitions, our main focus is actually getting through the process of these field tests and identifying those winners. Tomorrow is March 9th. That's actually the deadline for the Adult Literacy X Prize submissions. The teams in Global Learning submitted their solutions in mid-January. And we're going to go through a long process on both of these projects to really, as you said, have efficacy trials and prove that these things actually work. And then from there, scale it up.
Okay, and then if you have a message to people listening in, so educators, the whole gamut, investors, startups, blue chips, government, what would that message be?
Think differently about learning in general, and think differently about how children can access
quality learning through technology. I think to turn your back on it now is increasingly wrong. Because if you believe, again, as I said, that education and access to quality education, quality learning is, in fact, a human right, I think technology, you know, whether unfortunately or fortunately, is the only thing that can scale. And we need to focus like a laser on developing that which works. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're trying to do.
Okay, wonderful. And anything from you as well to end with?
Yeah, so lots of messages. But I think one thing that has always surprised me, and this is true of any field, but in education it can sometimes be disconcerting. There's a lot of resistance to change. Mm-hmm. And we have to remember that the way that we educate children and adults today is really it's the result of a very long process of experimentation. And even though there seems to be increasing willingness to try new things, sometimes I think there's a lot of resistance at different levels, right? So even though teachers might be willing to adopt something, you're not going to get the type of government support to allow for that widespread adoption. I think the more people think about putting aside entrenched interests and being much more focused, as Matt said, on providing what is essentially a human right to as many people as possible around the world, it's mind-boggling that there are over 300 million kids who simply don't have the right access to education to succeed. And you know, you think of what their lives are going to be like when they're adults. They're in countries that are rapidly urbanizing. People tend to be thinking about how to solve problems of the past as opposed to thinking what does the world look like 20 years from now? What does that mean for these kids who currently don't have access to education? Instead of fighting for funding, it should be a question of how do we actually create scale as quickly as possible.
Okay, thank you both so much for your time.
Thank you, Sophie.
So I've just had a really interesting chat with the guys at the Qatar Foundation International, and I'm here with Maggie Mitchell Salem. Is that pronounced correctly?
That's good.
Good. The executive director. So welcome, Maggie.
Thanks.
So my first question really is just to understand what you're doing at South by Southwest EDU, and I think this has been your third year here. So what really is the focus for you here? And for those that aren't familiar with the foundation, can you just give us an overview of what that's all about as well, please?
Sure. So we're really an extension of Qatar Foundation, which is a well-established Doha-based organization that's been working on K-20 education for over 20 years. And about 10 years ago, there was an interest in setting up another aspect of the foundation abroad, realizing that education is global and that there are best practices to be learned from everywhere. And so mm-hmm. how could that be done most effectively without everything having to be in Doha or coming to Doha? And so when we started, it was also looking at the needs of the community. So Qatar Foundation started, you know, K-20 school system, private K-12 schools, and then attracting the best UK and US universities from a number of different disciplines. And that met Qatar's needs. Understandably, we didn't need to be doing that in the US, the UK, Brazil, Canada. We needed to take a different approach. And so we focused on three different areas of priority that we thought bridged all of those communities. Arabic language and Arab culture. So K-12 instruction in a language that had next to no penetration in any of these countries outside of Islamic schools and maybe some elite private schools. Mm-hmm. STEAM, so STEM education plus the arts, because what unifies all of these countries, again, is an interest in having more math and science literate citizens at a minimum. Mm-hmm. And then the third area is, how do you connect young people in ways that are modern? You know, not just physical exchanges, but how do you connect classrooms online? How do you connect students online in ways that are safe and effective, but are also educational? So we weren't looking to reinvent Facebook. We were mm-hmm. really looking to find ways where a teacher who's trying to talk about, for example, the refugee crisis, can do something real that connects their students, who may be in Colorado, which is actually the case of one of our exchanges, with a community in Jordan. Mm-hmm. And what does that look like, and how do you do it, aside from the time differences, the technology issues?
So I was going to ask, I mean, so do you act as a kind of enabler between those two people?
Yeah.
And if so, do you partner with any one sort of tech supplier to help that make that happen?
So that's a really good question. On the tech side, we've let the classrooms decide for us. So the teachers either know what works, or we're working with a partner to your earlier question, like Global Nomads Group or Solia, that have established technology as part of the offering that they have.
Yeah.
So, you know, we haven't tried to, again, we're looking at how can we most effectively use our resources, and it's not by doing what others have done so well. So we didn't try to recreate anything.
Mm-hmm.
We looked at really strong organizations in the field, and so we actually helped bring together a small group, because at the time there was only a small group of virtual exchange providers.
Mm-hmm.
So I mentioned two, Solia and Global Nomads Group, but there were also other organizations that we supported and built a network. And now the Stevens Initiative that the State Department has launched about 3 years ago, being run by the Aspen Institute in Washington, that is actually now expanding exponentially access to quality virtual exchange as part of an educational program.
And before as well, we were sort of talking about when we go back to languages. So,
yeah.
I mean, from the perspective of EdTech startups that I speak to, it's quite often, you know, we've got this service and then, okay, the first iteration is English language. Right, now we're thinking about which language do we go into next, Spanish, and then perhaps after that, Mandarin.
Yeah.
Can you give listeners a little insight into perhaps what the state of play is with regards to Arabic as a language and the need for that within some of the territories that you work within, or say, for example, the UK and the US?
So we're finding a strong interest in K-12 Arabic across the board. Canada has had some really exceptional exposure and funded by the government. So there's actually a lot to learn in Canada from the work they've done. Chicago Public Schools, one of the biggest supporters of Arabic language is the public school system there. And it's an excellent program. So when we partnered with CPS, we didn't look at expanding Arabic. They didn't really need that. We looked at how we could support Arabic teachers with additional professional development, connect them to school systems that were starting their Arabic programs. So we always look at the convening function as part of what we do. On technology, to the question of gaming, we actually worked on the initial year of a school in LA, and I'm forgetting the name of the organization that we worked with. It was a gaming company that was looking to see how to engage gaming in the classroom. And we wanted it to be in Arabic, because we really think that's an opportunity for growth. The lack, as we were talking about earlier, of quality digital Arabic K-12, K-20 resources is a real need. And what if what we do is not just translate more stuff into Arabic? That often doesn't address the real problem. What if you leapfrog? You know, the MIT is doing some great work in Haiti on education after the earthquake. And one of their, the head of K-12 digital strategy at MIT, Vijay Kumar, said to me years ago, "Maggie, I'm not going to rebuild the Haitian education system. It was awful. We're going to leapfrog." So in a lot of ways, it's, let's not just go back and copy the same steps we had for English and Spanish. How do we look at Arabic and say, great, we have all of these kids who speak Arabic who have been out of school two or more years, living in countries as varied as Syria to Germany to the U.S. How do we help them maintain their mother tongue in a way that will really engage them, that might address some psychosocial issues that they're facing as part of being a refugee and having lived through a really terrible ordeal? And so it's, you know, technology for good, overused maybe phrase, but really addressing needs in a way that are modern and adaptive.
Have you had any conversations with tech refugees? Have you heard of those guys?
Mike Butcher.
Okay.
Know him well.
Yeah.
He's fabulous.
Yeah. I haven't met Mike, although I follow his tweets, but
Do you want me to introduce you? I'd love to. He's fabulous. Oh, my God. Mike is awesome.
Yeah, no, because they just ran their Disrupt event in the Queen Elizabeth Olympic Park, and I live about 30 seconds from there, so I really should have gone along, but it was just after Web Summit, and I thought I was going to fall over. I was too tired. but I think, I can't remember the lady's name. Is it Josephine? I think one of his team, I saw her speak at Web Summit, and she was so passionate about everything. And we connected. We haven't yet got around to doing an interview.
Yeah, no, but it's, you know, so, okay, that is, I think, a terrific community of tech entrepreneurs and enthusiasts who are trying to help. Mm. You know, the other question is, how do you structure needs? Mm. You know, and then how do you... And this is what I like about TechFugees. They're not just trying to say, we're the only ones with this knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
They're engaging refugees and solving their own problems.
That's exactly what she was talking about. And also the shock when people realize that those people in the room, when they do kind of community engagement stuff, oh, this person's just like me. And they're sort of like, oh, it's, you know, and that being a real turning point moment in the conversation. But, and in fact, in terms of refugees, from a UK perspective, our TES Blogger of the Year, again, I mentioned Natalie Scott. So she has done some teaching out in some of the refugee camps. But the conversation I had as well with Andrew Harper previously was, you know, when you're thinking about 65 million people, physical classrooms don't really cut it anymore.
Exactly.
So how do you innovate, and how do you use connected online teaching methods perhaps to kind of challenge that initial
idea? And then maybe
idea.
How do you have a revolution in teaching across the region?
Yeah.
I mean, how do you look at addressing the needs of people who need a solution today? To the problem of being out of school, of not having quality resources, not having any access to even a halfway decent education. But in a region where education has been failing the students, families, communities for years. And I think there's a real wag the dog moment here where you might find that what you've done for one community, especially because it should be digital, it should be online. Andrew's right, you can't build enough schools. You know, to meet this need. And this is going to be a population that's going to be mobile. So education should move with them.
And what's your own background? How did you get into all of this?
Well, I lived in Syria a long time ago.
Yeah.
And I lived with a Syrian family. And so I care very deeply about this issue. Right. But I'm, I guess, a jack of no trades. I worked at the State Department for a number of years, and then my only real abiding passion has been the Middle East and doing things that are authentic to those communities and with them. Because it's very true that often we think we have all these solutions, and what we do is cause more problems than delivering a solution. And
which is what Chris Emden's, as a local level, more here in the U.S., keynote was all about, actually. So you've got, like, you've got your friends, you've got frenemies and enemies, and the people that are well-meaning but perhaps do cause those problems as a result of not fully understanding. So
but I had a, you know, to be honest, what I also, you know, I have a mind to the needs there, but I think there's, I never want us to be us being the outside world, but really the Western world and Americans to be seen as anything other than I think we really are. And I think that's maybe not coming across in the US and the UK right now in a way that that we're comfortable with, at least those of us who feel comfortable in a world that is diverse and global and connected, and where people are treated fairly and equally and humanely. And so I think now more than ever, the work that we do at QFI, I work with a really amazing team of people who actually know what they're doing. Which is super helpful to me, that, you know, we're able to work with our communities in even stronger and deeper ways, because we're finding that there is a real resonance to our work now.
And so if I'm a teacher listening in, and I'm in the US or I'm in the UK, and I think actually from a continuous professional development point of view, you know, I'm interested either in your services there or perhaps how I can assist my student population, how can they get in contact with you and find out more about, you know, how you might work together?
Sure. So on our website, really a very 1.0 technology tool, if you go to qfi.org, there's a page under grants. I know we are so retro. It's actually updated quite frequently, even though that may be an anachronism. And you'll see on a grants page, there are ways to get in touch with us. We work with schools. We work with teachers. We're really about community. So if there's a way that an existing program needs some support, or there are a set of schools, we love it when there's a progression from elementary to middle to high school, wants to look at starting a program, we can help even with the advice on how to get that going. And then there's also the cultural aspect. So even if you don't think maybe Arabic is what your community is interested in, or ideally, if you want to engage the community in a discussion of the Middle East, so that, you know, some people feel afraid, and we understand that, or don't understand, or worry about being stigmatized, you know, a great introduction is some quality cultural resources.
Well, actually, that's one question that I always ask people is, if there are any books or resources that you think would be useful for people to who are listening. So, if you have any references that you'd like to give.
ArabicAlMustar.org. So that's our site, but we don't heavily brand it deliberately because it's meant to be a community site where teachers, it's open education resources.
Yeah.
So ArabicAlMustar, all one word, ALMASDAR.org. And you can find on the Arabic language side, resources mainly in Arabic, of course. But then on the Arab culture side, resources mainly in English that look at the refugee crisis, look at different aspects of Arab culture. Because actually, I should say Arab cultures, because it's not from Morocco to Iraq, Syria to Saudi Arabia. There's a lot of diversity.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like sort of... homogenizing it doesn't really help. So, and how about a book that may have influenced you as a person that you continue to go back to, and it doesn't have to be, you know, to do with your work now, but something that kind of influenced you?
So, I'm going to recommend three books.
Okay, brilliant.
Let the Great World Spin, fabulous book. Colin McCullum, I think. Absolutely fabulous book. Second book is... Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World, one of my favorites, and I have had so many people who I've given this book to. It's funny, I'm an evangelical leader.
You're like bumping
of the
up their
modern
sales.
Genghis Khan movement. Okay, that's probably not what my communication instructor wants me to say, but he makes me look so kind as a leader.
Okay, there you go.
By reflection. So it's a fabulous book, Jack Weatherford, and highly readable, and you won't put it down.
Is it? I'm imagining that's quite a monster.
Not at all.
No,
it's about 250 pages, and it is amazing. Genghis Khan built more bridges than any other leader, bridges, physical bridges, and he moved people around on a human supply chain. You know, doctors from China going to Iran, Iranians going to Egypt. He looked at the world without borders, and it's just incredible. Anyway, I don't want to ruin the ending, so. And then the third book, it's more on the Middle East, and it's The Arab Peoples, and it's by Albert Hourani, and it's really an excellent book about the Arab world.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. Well, so thank you very much. And I think you're on Twitter as well.
Yeah.
So how can people find you on Twitter?
At Mags Mitchell.
Mags Mitchell. Mags with an S, not
with
a streetwise Z.
And L, two L's. And then QFI.
Yeah.
You can always find me on QFI at QFINTL. QF
Wonderful.
International.
Thank you so much, Maggie.
Thank you.
It's Wednesday the 8th, and I'm here with Mark Nagurski from Makematic. So welcome, Mark.
Thank you.
So, Mark, can you tell us a little bit about what Makematic is and what you do and your kind of mission here this
Sure.
week?
So we're a content production company. We focus explicitly on education stuff. So we make a lot of the bite-sized revision guides for the BBC. So a lot of short-form, live-action and animated content, but really kind of trying to engage young people just in a slightly different way with a quality of content that they enjoy engaging with. And this week, we've just started work on a new series of professional development masterclasses, so kind of more aimed at the teachers. So this week's really been about developing some interesting partnerships around that and trying to figure out why teachers dislike professional development so much and see if we can do something about that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a... Do you know the Teacher Development Trust in the UK?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess that's their kind of mission, isn't it? It's like, you know, perhaps teachers previously have been rather poorly served in terms of what they need rather than what others think they need.
Yeah, I think they've been incredibly poorly served. I mean, I don't come from an education background. That's the first thing I'm telling everybody here.
Yeah, it's always a good disclaimer.
Yeah, but, you know, when we look around and we look at, you know, professional development resource in, you know, in the technology space or in law or in architecture or whatever, you know, the quality of the content there and the provision there is substantially higher and different than what's available in education, which just seems odd.
Yeah.
And I don't understand entirely why that is, but that's the kind of that's the challenge we're setting ourselves to see if we can come up with something better.
Absolutely. And so what is your background and how did you come in to do what you're doing now?
Sure. So again, nothing to do with education. I came through kind of more of a technology smut. I used to run digital media festivals and events across Ireland and the UK. And gradually over time, they kind of started to slant more towards a younger audience. So inviting more students and their parents and teachers along. And you know, part of the thinking behind that was, great, let's engage kids with some of these technologies earlier, which I'm a huge believer in.
Yeah.
But we just kind of had this sense that every time we were doing that, you know, it wasn't translating back to the classroom because the teachers didn't have the resources or they hadn't been prepared or whatever it may be. And then just the mechanics of getting things into a classroom as well. So that kind of prompted a shift probably about a year, 18 months ago in saying, well, you know, if this is something I honestly believe in, let's see if we can do something about it.
So who have you been meeting here? What have you? Is it about partnerships and extending what you're doing into the US or?
Yeah, I suppose partnerships is the primary aim of this trip. The way we're approaching the professional development resources, we can see there are lots of amazing universities and museums and technology companies who sometimes have existing PD programs, which is great, but they don't scale very well. They tend to be workshop-based or event-based or whatever. So we're speaking to them and saying, how can we take what you already do and do very well and kind of bring that sort of BBC sensibility to it in terms of turning it into amazing content.
Mm-hmm.
So again, we've been speaking to national museums, some of the kind of Ivy League universities, and a lot of the big technology providers.
And I know Simon Nelson is here this week from FutureLearn. I don't know if
absolutely. We've had a conversation with FutureLearn already. I think, again, you know, when we look at some of the content that's available, some of it is amazing, some of it not so much. But the actual provision for professional development, specifically around technology, there's just simply not a lot of it. You know, so, you know, we're thinking, well, there's a lot of technologies that teachers might want to use in the classroom. How do we help facilitate that? So our view on it is that's going to take a long time and a very specific focus. So we think there's something certainly complementary there. So we've had those conversations with FutureLearn and all the others as well.
And the other one I was thinking of is I also interviewed the editorial director from TED-Ed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, to be honest, I mean, one set of meetings that we're having this week are with the big, you know, the big exhibitions and events and conferences.
Yep.
Because fundamentally, they're about, you know, in a large way about professional development.
Absolutely,
so you have,
yeah.
I don't know how many teachers, 10,000 teachers here this week, all of them committing time, energy and resource to improving their skill, their craft, their profession. But again, it's the same thing. You know, for every 10,000 there are here, there's another million who can't make it here.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you scale up some of the experience that you would find at one of the events or a publisher's experience or a university's kind of outreach programs? How do you scale that to effectively reach far more teachers?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obvious answer is commit that to film. That's great. But doing it in such a way that teachers actually enjoy engaging with it, I think, is a different dynamic. And I suppose, you know, the way we've been talking about it this week and what's come very clear for us is this really needs to be almost like a Netflix for teachers. It's something mm-hmm. they can kind of, they want to dive into and they want to spend some time with, and it doesn't feel like a chore.
Mm. And if people want to get in contact with you to explore potential collaboration, how can they do that?
We're all over the place. So Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all Makematic. Or just myself, Mark, M-A-R-K, at makematic.com. And we'll be more than happy to chat to anybody.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mark.
No problem.
So I'm back outside looking over the beautiful view in Austin downtown. And I'm here now with Tricia Edwards. who works as head of education at the Smithsonian Lemelson Center for the Study of Invention and Innovation, which is an amazing title. Welcome, Tricia.
Thank you.
So, Tricia, for those listening from around the world, could you explain what it is that you do on a day-to-day basis and also the Lemelson Center in particular as well?
Sure. So the Lemelson Center is part of the National Museum of American History, and obviously you can tell by our name, we specifically study invention and innovation. And our mission is really to engage, educate, and empower people to participate in social, technological, and economic change. So oftentimes invention and innovation feels like something that happens to us, yes, and we don't have control over it. So what we really want to do is help people understand it and understand how they can participate in it. So participating in it might be the way they cast a vote, it might be giving user feedback on a product, or it might be actually inventing something.
So do you create sort of frameworks for other people out there doing innovation can use to kind of make that process less intimidating, or how does that manifest itself as well?
So actually a big part of my work as head of education is running something that we call Spark Lab, and it is a hands-on invention lab for kids and families, and it's really trying to kind of demystify what invention is and allow kids accessible, fun, but meaningful and authentic ways to engage in the invention process. And so we've, based on our work with inventors over the last 20 plus years and also researching historic inventors, understanding their process. And so we've broken the process down into 7 steps. And so we work with kids to kind of lead them through that process. It's not a linear process, so we don't necessarily go step by step, but how do you go from having an idea, which is what we call the think it step, to creating a prototype, testing it, trying it, and then all the way to the sell it stage, which is how do you talk to somebody about your invention, and maybe even bring it to market?
That's really interesting, because a lot of people, they don't have the whole skill set needed to kind of take that product from an idea. They might, have the amazing idea, but then that's quite a different skill set sometimes to communicating that to someone that doesn't understand it. So it's really interesting to hear as well, because in the UK we have people like James Dyson, which, yes, looks like you know who that is, which of course you would. But kind of running a campaign as well to say that, we need to encourage invention more, and perhaps that's part of our heritage as well in the UK, and that we could support it more. And I'm guessing that something similar is happening here as well, and as well with the movement around STEM and STEAM, but just taking that back to what does that mean in reality, and the creation of new ideas and new inventions is, I think, sometimes connects with people in a more meaningful way than an acronym or something like that.
Yeah, I think it does. It also feels very much like something that other people do. So what we try to do is, through lots of different ways, let people understand that really everyone is inventive, right? We all solve problems every single day. And so while, we may not all grow up to be, Thomas Edison or James Dyson, but we all are, humans are innately problem solvers. And so, we try to provide a range of role models for kids to see, like when they come into Spark Lab, or even in our public programming that we do, when we invite inventors in to talk to the public, we make sure that, there are different ages, and there are men and women, and there are different racial and ethnic backgrounds, and they work in different fields. Not all invention is high tech, which is something that can be very intimidating. So really trying to broaden people's understanding about what invention is, who invents, and really trying to get people to understand that it's something that they can do too.
And the actual center, does that also kind of house a history or, a place to go to learn about inventors that have gone before? And I'm just thinking about the museum side of it. Does it have a museum of that kind as well, or is it more the hands-on
stuff?
Yeah,
so we do a couple of different things.
We're all about the background noise on this podcast.
So we do. We have the public education side, which I've been speaking about, which includes not only Spark Lab, but an exhibition gallery where we have rotating exhibitions on different invention topics. We do a lot of public programming, but then we also have a scholarly side of our house. So we do have historians on our staff who are researching and publishing about invention and innovation. We collect the archives of inventors, so the paper documents. And so that is a big part of what we do. And then we often use that historic research to then apply it to things that we do on the public engagement side. So How do we make that research accessible, whether it's a program or a hands-on activity or an exhibition?
Okay, and wonderful. And you were speaking on a panel here just before we connected.
Yes.
So what were you speaking about on that panel?
Our panel was called Inspiring Student Innovation Through Competitions. And so we run an online invention competition that's sort of an online extension of our Spark Lab. And I was on a panel with two other people who run similar challenges. And we had a student inventor who has won all of the challenges. Oh. Talk about how she invents. And so it was really trying to help teachers in particular understand how to integrate these things into the classroom.
What was that person's name? Do you remember
her name is Alexis Lewis.
Okay, great.
Yes, and she's won the challenge that I run, and she's won a number of others. She's spoken at the White House. She has two patents, and she's 17. So she's a great example of what can happen
when
we
example.
Empower kids.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. I mean, I've heard people speak previously, so people like, I'm trying to remember his name now, Jack.
Andraka,
that's it, on pancreatic cancer and others, and it is really amazing. And I think it is giving people that platform and putting it out there, and what comes back is truly remarkable sometimes. So what's your own background, and how did you get into this role?
So I actually started out my career as a preschool teacher and really loved education, but decided that, you know, the classroom environment wasn't going to be something that was kind of a long-term career path for me. But in college, I'd had a number of internships in museums, and so I really liked the idea of being able to combine working in museums with education, and took some detours along the way, but eventually found my way to a job at a natural history museum, actually working in the education department. And then I've worked in a couple of other museums before I landed at the Smithsonian, where I've been 11 years next week.
Wowzers, yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And we were talking about the fact that the Smithsonian is coming to the Olympic Park in London as well, which is very exciting.
Yep, yeah, a partnership with V&A. So yeah. I think there's still a lot to work out, but I think it's exciting for the Smithsonian to think about. We really see ourselves in this day and age as a global institution, not just about U.S. culture and U.S. things. So it's a really exciting step for the institution.
Absolutely. And what was your own education like? So was ask people, you know, how they experienced it, how that kind of shapes how they think about it as well.
Yeah, I mean, I loved school always. I was a kid that always really liked school and liked learning. But I also recognized that I had tons of opportunities that most kids don't get. My parents took us to lots of museums, which is why I think I ended up working in one. So I think I sort of think about how can we make sure we're providing all kids with experiences like I had. And I think we think a lot about at the Smithsonian about how do we broaden access and make sure that we're providing equitable opportunities to kids everywhere.
And do you do a lot of digital or VR content? I know that a lot of museums are thinking but that potentially is a way of both increasing access into what you do, but also increasing access to the perhaps physical artifacts that you can't always get out on the show floor or something like that.
Yeah, the Smithsonian has, for a number of years, has had a large digitization effort. So digitizing collections in all the 19 museums and then getting that information online. Some of it is just the object and its information, but some of the objects actually have, you know, curriculum around them and their lesson plans. And there's also a great, great resource that launched about this time last year called it's the Smithsonian Learning Lab, and they have aggregated resources from all over the institution, you know, 3D scans of things, but also copies of artwork and documents from the archives and music from the Folkways music collections. And so anybody, but particularly teachers, can go in and kind of curate their own collections and create whole lessons and units around it. It really empowers the teacher not just to say, here's this resource we've developed for you, but the teachers to actually develop their
That's
own. It's really cool.
And do you have any favorite inventors of your own?
Favorite inventors? Gosh, I have a lot that I like to talk about. I think one of my favorites is Stephanie Kwalik. She invented Kevlar, which is bullet-resistant material. And she, I know this is a podcast, but I wish I could show a photograph, because when people see her, they say, well, she doesn't look like an inventor. She looks like my grandmother. And I think she's a great example of, like, inventors don't all look like...
she didn't have a white lab coat on.
And she's not a man. And but then I think there's also...
Just on that one, I heard on a Tim Ferriss podcast, I think it was the other day, certainly a podcast of some kind, that now people are developing human skin that basically uses assets or qualities from spider silk thread, I think, to create bulletproof skin.
Wow.
Which is insane.
That's amazing. Yeah.
And that's actually a real thing, which is pretty terrifying as well.
Yes. But,
so I would be great. Is she still about?
No, she actually passed away just a couple of years ago. But she, I think, you know, in addition to being an inventor, I mean, she worked for the DuPont company and was one of the only female chemists who was working there at a time. So it was really pushing, you know, gender barriers at the same time. And
do you know that Margaret Thatcher also was a chemist and invented Mr. Whippy ice cream, or the precursor to what was then made Mr. Whippy ice cream become available?
I had no idea. Yeah, that's really cool. And that's just proof that inventors really are all around us. And, you know, they're not always the people that we suspect.
Absolutely. And if people want to get in contact with you or what you do and kind of reach out, how's the best way for them to go about that?
They can certainly visit the Lemelson Center's website, which is invention.si.edu. And you can see all of the center's great work up there. And of course, my contact information is there as well.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Tricia.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Next up, a word from Class Central, which if you're into geeking out over online learning and MOOC reports like I am, you'll probably already know about. Unless you've been asleep, MOOCs or massive online open courses are changing the way we experience higher and further education and workplace learning. With significant online courses available, gaining insight into this fast-paced world is worth spending time on, especially for those implicated by such changes. That's where Class Central comes in. Not only does it list hundreds of courses, and importantly, including non-profit courses as well as the big Ivy League unis, but the MOOC Report blog has some excellent analysis on what's up, down, new, or just slightly left-field. So definitely go and check it out at www.class-central.com/report and let me know what you think. Thanks for listening, everyone. If you want to mix with other listeners, join our new Facebook group online where we'd love to connect you and hear your feedback. And have a wonderful week, and see you next time.